all of the questions were asked more than once by different people, kind of giving me a feeling that the answers were not clear or satisfactory.
Ketchikan residents want answers from Representative Kyle Johansson. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 16th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Eagle residents say the Park Service is too heavy-handed.
The Park Service have escalated their behavior to the point where they're actually putting people down in the mud and handcuffing them.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
Elections officials have counted all the ballots they have from the general election held 2 weeks ago, and with only a small number of absentee ballots to be computer counted tomorrow, Lisa Murkowski's write-in campaign is leading Joe Miller by 10,380 votes. The total ballot count for Murkowski now stands at 100,868, compared to Miller's 90,448. Murkowski's votes include 8,153 ballots that have been challenged by Miller observers. This means Lisa Murkowski is winning without the challenged ballots. Miller has not conceded. His campaign is awaiting the final few hundred absentee ballots to be counted. Last night, Ketchikan constituents wanted answers from their representative, Republican Kyle Johansson, about his reasons for stepping away from a House leadership position. As KRBD's Deanna Maria Dudzak reports, his answers didn't do much to alleviate their concerns.
About 60 people met with Representative Kyle Johansson at a closed meeting with House District 1 Republicans. The meeting was held in the conference room at Jeremiah's Restaurant in Ketchikan on Monday night. The event was closed to the press and general public. The Republicans called the meeting to give Johansson an opportunity to explain why he vacated his position as House Majority Leader and left the House Majority Caucus during its November 5th organizational meeting. District 1 Republican Chair Dick Koos is also a member of the Ketchikan City Council. After attending a special City Council meeting earlier in the evening, Koos arrived at the District 1 meeting about an hour into the event. He says people were generally cordial during the portion of the meeting he attended. He says most questions centered on what Johansson planned to do to effectively serve District 1.
And he feels that he can get back in with the caucus and help us out. He wasn't saying a definite time frame when that would happen. And I think that was the main theme as to how you're going to do it, when you're going to do it, and when are we going to know that anything's happening.
Koos says Johansson answered all questions asked during the approximately two-hour meeting. However, he says some didn't feel their questions were answered adequately.
Several of the questions were asked more than once by different people, kind of giving me a feeling that the answers were not clear or satisfactory.
Koos says the purpose of the meeting was to give Johansson a chance to explain his actions and answer questions. He says no actions were taken or decisions made on Monday night. Republican John Hudson also attended Monday night's meeting. He says though Johansson answered all questions, he felt concerns were not fully addressed.
He explained his motivation, why he did what he did. And he did it in a way that led me to believe that he really has convictions where this thing is concerned. But what he didn't address was our concerns and the fact that some of us don't necessarily agree with his actions. He didn't address that.
Republican Roger Stone had a stronger view of the general feeling of the meeting.
Very anti-Kyle.
Stone says he and others are angered by the decisions Johansson made.
I think everybody in the room felt that he's made a huge mistake and that he's not going to be able to appropriately represent Ketchikan nor exert any influence in terms of what the needs of Ketchikan and Southeast are. Resigning from the caucus and stepping to the outside does not put him in a position where he's going to be able to have any influence or control of any of this legislation or anything in terms of how it affects Ketchikan and the rest of the state, for that matter.
Stone says, in his opinion, Johansson should resign.
I don't think that given what he's done that he can adequately represent Ketchikan or Southeast, and I think he should offer his resignation and potentially step down and work with the Republican group to come up with a satisfactory successor that will do a better job of representing Ketchikan and Southeast.
Coos says that several times during the meeting, Johansson stated he would hold a public meeting, but no time or date were specified. Asked if he could confirm whether or not a meeting was taking place, Johansson's chief of staff, David Scott, stated he could only confirm what he read in the paper. The Ketchikan Daily News on Tuesday had reported that Johansson says he plans to have a public meeting soon at the Ted Ferry Civic Center. Johansson did not return phone calls requesting an interview for this story. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
Eagle residents upset about National Park Service law enforcement in the Yukon-Charley Rivers Preserve have voiced their concerns in a letter. Members of the Yukon River Community City Council have written to the Park Service, Alaska's congressional delegation, Governor Parnell, and state legislators about what they call a heavy-handed approach of park rangers who enforce Coast Guard regulations on the Yukon River. Park Service rangers enforcing boat registration and safety regs resulted in some confrontations and arrests this summer. Eagle City Council member Don Woodruff says the agency is stepping out of bounds to harass boaters.
The Park Service in the past 4 years, if we go back a little bit in history, have escalated their behavior to the point where they're actually putting people down in the mud and handcuffing them.
Woodruff says the actions have destroyed 20 years of good relations between the Park Service and the region's small group of local residents. The letter accuses the agency of bringing in military-trained rangers who violate locals' subsistence rights guaranteed under the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act. It challenges federal authority on the river's navigable waters and asks the state attorney general to join an action to prohibit Park Service law enforcement on the Yukon River, suggesting the job would be better handled by state-sanctioned village public safety officers. Woodruff says an intermediate step would be to at least base Park Service officials in Eagle.
Having a station manager in town here like we used to have, and the ranger stationed in town like we used to have, you know, 6-7 years ago, and that way they're part of the community and they understand our lifestyle. They interact with us on a daily basis.
Woodruff says the community is also pushing for establishment of local committees that could regularly meet with preserve managers to talk about issues. Fairbanks-based Yukon-Charley Superintendent Greg Dudgeon says he's only seen unsigned email copies of the letter and will not comment on the issues it raises. He says the agency is awaiting the result of a court case involving a central man arrested by park rangers during a boat safety check on the Yukon this summer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a brand new market for a very old fish.
In one of the markets we have is for pharmaceutical oils.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
Members of the Federal Subsistence Management Board last week heard comments from a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service enforcement agent who said a 2-year investigation is looking into allegations that subsistence fish are being sold to non-subsistence users. Although the agent, Stan Pruzenski, spoke at the board meeting, he was not allowed to be interviewed because the case is still ongoing. The investigation centers around salmon from the Yukon River. Subsistence Management Assistant Regional Director Pete Probasco says customary trade is the legal selling of fish for cash.
What has occurred over the years, particularly as it pertains to Yukon and particularly as it pertains to Chinook, is the concern of the subsistence users that that's being abused. In other words, instead of just exchanging small amounts for small amounts of cash, it's growing.
Probasco says it became a big enough issue that Fish and Wildlife reports say an investigation was needed and some sales were large.
They're selling processed fish that don't go through an inspected facility, and that's a requirement in the state that any processed fish have to meet those type of requirements. And some of these sales are in the thousands of dollars.
Probasco says Agent Pruszynski wouldn't share all of the information because the investigation is continuing, but he says sales of that size are going beyond the federal users the program was intended for.
The cases were made with the sales going from within the state of Alaska outside to a commercial buyer, a set up commercial buyer in Arizona. So you have that type of level that the regulations that were adopted were not meant to allow.
Probasco says that concerns legitimate subsistence users.
You have subsistence users that recognize the importance of these type of subsistence uses. All subsistence uses are treated equal, barter, customary trade, sales for cash, etc. And they recognize the importance to safeguard that. And they also recognize that if it's abused, there's a strong potential that additional regulations would curtail the activities that the regulations were trying to protect.
Probasco says the amount of cash that can be exchanged is handled on a case-by-case basis. He says some areas such as Bristol Bay and Copper River have set cash limits, but others allow cash sales as long as it doesn't constitute a significant commercial enterprise. U.S. Fish and Wildlife spokesman Bruce Wood says he couldn't discuss whether other areas beyond the Yukon are being investigated, nor could he say how long it may be until information can be released. Federal Subsistence Board Chairman Tim Tworek says Fish and Wildlife has their investigation into alleged abuses, but he says during the recent Alaska Federation of Natives convention in Fairbanks, there were reports from some Alaska Natives of overreaction from agents who confiscated fish. Tworek says board members need more information.
We charge ourselves as board members to, if there's a problem with regulations, then we need to take a look at those regulations and figure out what's good for the people and their continued use of subsistence food and, making some money to pay for gas and things like that. So we're having our staff review the case and hopefully come up with a plan in the future to address that situation on the Yukon.
The next meeting of the Federal Subsistence Board will be in January in Anchorage. Proposed fishery regulation changes are on the agenda for action. The annual eel run will be starting any day now on the lower Yukon River. The lamprey eel is not only an important subsistence resource, it's a chance for some villagers to make a little money too. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
The snake-like fish bursts up the river much like the smelt run on the Kuskokwim River. If you blink, it could be gone.
It's a very compressed run. They don't run for, 4 or 5 days. It's a day or two, and then they're gone.
Jack Schulteis has been looking forward to the annual migration of Yukon eels for the past 7 years. He's the general manager of Quipoc Fisheries, the CDQ group for the lower Yukon River, and they plan to buy lampreys again this year.
Lamprey contains about 30% oil. And one of the markets we have is for pharmaceutical oils.
Lamprey eels are one of the oldest living fish in the world. They can grow up to 2 feet long and weigh about a third to a half a pound each. They have small fins that run along the length of their bodies and have sucker-shaped round mouths for attaching to other fish which they feed off of. The commercial opening targeting lampreys mainly draws in fishermen from Russian Mission upriver to Grayling simply because of logistics. Quipoc has just one buying station at Grayling. Schulteis says they concentrate there because there's a better chance for everyone to be ready.
We've tried in the lower river villages, but it's very iffy because you're not sure when they're showing up. Where the further you go upriver, it's easy to document their travel time based on when people caught them below you.
It's a very limited commercial opening with a 40,000-pound maximum. Schulteis says they've only made that much once. Usually, they bring in around 20 to 25,000 pounds. Schulteis says for a successful harvest, there are several factors that have to be just right, including the ice conditions and knowing exactly when the lamprey are moving under the ice.
That's what's always been a problem with the this fishery and the volume of fish we get, is everything, you know, all the stars got to line up, you know, directly or properly to be successful with it volume-wise.
But even though the commercial lamprey fishery is small, there's a market for them that Schultheis doesn't think will go away.
We're one of the few open fisheries anywhere in the world for lamprey. Lampreys are very susceptible to pollution. So most of the big lamprey producing areas of, you know, eastern United States, the Mediterranean, most of those fisheries are gone just because there's no eels left.
Quipoc has been paying local fishermen $1.50 a pound for lampreys in recent years.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
The Obama administration will host a second Tribal Nations Summit next month. White House Senior Policy Advisor for Native American Issues, Kimberly Teehee, announced plans for the gathering yesterday at the National Congress of American Indians Annual Convention, the country's largest gathering of tribal leaders and governments. The December 16th summit will be held in Washington, and each of the nation's 565 federally recognized tribes will be invited to send one representative. This year's wildfire season began early and stretched late into the fall, and that's up the state's cost of managing fires. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The state spent $66.6 million so far this fiscal year to fight fires in Alaska. State Forester Chris Mache says the State Forestry Division is spending overall more these days for fire suppression, both because the fires are starting earlier and the season is lasting longer, well into the fall. He says this past fire season started especially hot and heavy.
It was dry. To be honest, I was pretty concerned the way the fire season started this year, because May was an all-time record breaker for us. And off to a, depending on your perspective, a bad or a good start. If you're a firefighter, it was a good start because you were making lots of money. To everyone else, it was like, oh my God.
About 1.1 million acres have burned this year in the state. That makes 2010 the fourth most active fire season this decade. It's down from the nearly 3 million acres that burned in 2009 and well below the 6.5 million acre 2004 fire season and 2005's 4.7 million acres. Mache says the earlier and longer seasons mean the state is paying more for fire suppression, nearly $8.9 million this fiscal year for payroll. That's good news for Alaskans who depend on those firefighting wages. Businesses also are benefiting due to forestry paying more for contracts to lease equipment and facilities around the state.
Heavy equipment like cats, we're doing fire line rehab, we're hiring excavators and different pieces of equipment, you know, low boys to transport equipment. A lot of times we're hiring boats out in communities to transport firefighters and to, you know, get them around on the fire. So it's a whole variety.
Local governments also benefit. For example, the Forestry Division paid the Delta Greeley School District $32,000 last summer to lease an elementary school as a headquarters for suppressing the Gills Creek Fire near the Pogo Gold Mine. Hundreds of firefighters from around Alaska and other states camped on the high school's athletic fields. Forestry also leased the Delta Ice Hockey Arena for $14,000 to provide a place for fire personnel to sleep, eat, and shower while fighting Gills Creek and other area blazes. Delta City Manager Mike Twangy said those dollars went to good use.
What we use that money for is to just provide recreation for the community, so it's a win for everyone, really.
In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
The Alaska Miners Association held its annual convention recently in Anchorage, though a lot of the talk was about fish. KMXT's Jay Barrett explains.
Representatives from the United Fishermen of Alaska, a coalition of fishing organizations from around the state, were the invited guests of the miners at their annual meeting. It was the idea of Steve Grabacki, a freelance fisheries biologist and industry consultant.
There's a lot lot of anxiety, as we all know, about mining in Alaska and about, especially among the fishing industry. The idea that I had in going into this and setting up the Mining and Fisheries Short Course was to try to dispel some of that anxiety by increasing information. The short course and the recap session were extremely well received. The whole idea was originally to educate miners about fisheries, fishing, habitat protection, and, for example, Title 16 permitting. The addition of the fishing people to tell the miners about fishing was an added bonus. Everyone was pleased.
Arnie Thompson, president of the UFA, says the reception of the fishermen by the miners was surprisingly good.
It was very positive overall. And we were pleasantly surprised. They introduced us all on Friday at lunch and got a good hand. And a number of folks came up and talked to us. So we all expressed interest in keeping up the conversation. And, you know, UFA recognizes that other resource industries, you know, they need business. They need new development. So I guess we all need to work together.
Thompson cited the success of the process surrounding development of the Kensington mine near Juneau as an example of how input from fishermen can be a win-win for everyone involved.
Back in the late 90s and 2000, there were a number of UFA organizations that were involved in discussions and negotiations with Kensington, the UFA groups making recommendations for environmental protections. And so it turned out to be a very productive process. And as representatives of UFA, we were pleased to see the interest that the other mining groups had in the types of protections and what Kensington went through to get what you call the buy-offs from various agencies and some of the environmental groups.
Overall, according to Grabacki, mining remains healthy in the state of Alaska. For example, the Red Dog Mine near Kotzebue recently started working a new vein of zinc, and Shalista Corporation is advancing on the Donlin Creek Gold Mine in southwest Alaska.
The mining industry is a bit like the fishing industry because it depends on what you're mining and what you're selling. What we have are really high gold prices, generally high prices for precious metals, and then even base metals such as the lead and zinc that's produced at Red Dog are coming up in price. Coal has a separate market because it's an energy substance rather than a metal of any sort. But generally speaking, the mining industry is healthy and robust and making some significant progress.
At the forefront of many fishermen's minds is the proposed pebble mine near the headwaters of Bristol Bay's lucrative salmon fishery and a proposed open-pit coal mine on the west side of Cook Inlet, which would be dug across a salmon-spawning stream. In Kodiak, I'm Jay Barrett.
For a few days last week, the nation's eyes turned to Juneau, where the counting of write-in ballots in Alaska's U.S. Senate race attracted members of the national and even international press. They've all packed up and gone now, but for a time, the state capitol was swarming with more reporters than it's seen since maybe the heyday of Palin mania. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
Tristan McAllister had perhaps the most unique perspective of any member of the national media covering the write-in count. He grew up in Juneau and returned to his hometown as a producer for NBC News.
It's been sort of a nice, I guess, home court advantage.
McAllister now lives in Portland, Oregon, and does freelance work for all the television networks. He was one of two producers and a cameraman NBC sent to Alaska along with correspondent Kristen Welker. He says they were in the state during the campaign, too, covering debates in Anchorage. He says Alaska's U.S. Senate race had a lot of subplots that national audiences found fascinating.
There's sort of these undertones here of Florida and other things that have been in the political past of the United States, the recent political past of the United States, that make it sort of relevant. And I think that's why we're here. I think that's why it really matters to a lot of people. And beyond that, it seems that it's democracy in action.
CNN, Fox, NPR, The Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, and New York Times all had reporters in Juneau for the first 3 days of the write-in count. New York Times reporter William Yardley spent one afternoon trailing elections director Gail Finumiai for a feature story. Then there were Alaska-based reporters from the Associated Press, Anchorage Daily News, Alaska Dispatch, KTUU, and APRN. The media circus reached a new level of crazy Friday when Joe Miller advisor Floyd Brown held his second press conference in as many days. Brown alleged fraud and manipulation in the elections process, but the media were having none of it. Several reporters questioned his qualifications to speak on Alaska issues.
I think one guy said I was the one-day expert on Alaska. I've actually been here a lot. I'm only from Washington State, which is right around the corner.
Even Dan Springer, correspondent for conservative Fox News, brought up Brown's past attacks against Democrats Michael Dukakis and Bill Clinton and asked whether Brown was helping or hurting the Miller campaign. That led to this exchange.
It was 22 years ago, okay?
Can I finish my question?
Yeah, it was 22 years ago.
George Gordon distanced himself from calling your tactics sleazy. The whole idea that Bill Clinton was behind the suicide of a woman. How do you respond to that and your presence here? You obviously are very careful to not say that you're speaking for the Miller campaign. So you must believe that your presence here carries some baggage.
I don't. Not at all.
Brown hasn't held a press conference since then. Not that there'd be many reporters for him to talk to. Most of the national media cleared out Friday night and Saturday, and even the Anchorage press was gone by Sunday. So it came as a surprise to nearly everyone at the count site when a crew from Al Jazeera English showed up. Correspondent Nick Spicer says they were in Anchorage filming What Else?, a feature on the Sarah Palin's Alaska TV show, and did a detour to cover the count.
We're interested in this story to see what kind of national significance it might have, whether the what appears to be the impending defeat of the Tea Party candidate and the candidate who was anointed by Sarah Palin represents anything on the national scale. Is there a sort of reasonableness, let's say, amongst or moderation amongst Alaskan Republicans that the rest of the United States will be slowly waking up to?
Spicer, who's based at Al Jazeera's Washington, D.C. bureau, says he's covered elections around the world, including the Middle East and Western Europe. He tried to put this one in perspective.
Elections can get very scary and very violent, and it's not happening here. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to see, and if you think this is messy, you know, you're fooling yourself. It's wonderful.
And maybe that's a perspective more Alaskans need to have. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan, Dan Ross and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Jay Barrett in Kodiak, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
And by
the Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.